This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. In his State of the Union address, U.S. President Trump steered clear of any references to the impeachment. Instead, as AP's Sagar Magani reports, he bragged about the country's fortunes under his watch.
In his State of the Union address, President Trump made no mention of impeachment while bragging about America's fortunes under his watch. The president steered clear of impeachment, instead touting his 3 years in office.
Our country is thriving.
Declaring the State of the Union is stronger than ever. But the sharp divide with Democrats was on full display.
Members of Congress, the President of the United States.
From House Speaker Nancy Pelosi skipping over the usual language of high honor and distinct privilege while introducing the president, to him ignoring her offer of a handshake, though it's unclear whether he saw it. Democrats booed several times during the speech. And as Republicans cheered the president's finale, Pelosi ripped her copy of the address in half and threw it on her desk. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Meanwhile, President Trump's call for drug price reductions touched off demonstrations by Democrats during his address.
During the State of the Union address, President Trump called for a reduction in drug prices. That set off this planned demonstration of Democrats chanting H.R. 3. H.R. 3 is a House-passed bill to allow Medicare to negotiate lower prices on insulin and other crucial prescription drugs. The bill, one of many that have not been addressed by the Republican-controlled Senate. A short while later, Trump claimed Democrats are determined to
abolish private insurance entirely. 132 lawmakers in this room have endorsed legislation to impose a socialist takeover of our health care system.
Tim McGuire, Washington.
And this is VOA News. The results from the Iowa caucuses continue to trickle in after a technical meltdown that delayed the outcome for nearly a full day. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
With nearly two-thirds of the Iowa precincts tabulated and announced, the early results show former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders leading the opening contest. Buttigieg is campaigning in New Hampshire, the live free or die state.
Free means more than just living free from government interference. Sure, sometimes it means just that. Like ensuring that the government stays out of the business of dictating to women what their reproductive health care choices ought to be.
And Sanders is there, too.
Today marks the beginning of the end for Donald Trump.
Iowa Democratic Party Chair Troy Price is apologizing for what he calls a coding error, but says that he's confident the results coming out now are correct. President Trump easily won the GOP contest. I'm Jackie Quinn.
The World Health Organization is warning that false information circulating on social media about the new coronavirus is hampering efforts to tackle the epidemic. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Sylvie Briand is the director of WHO's Global Infectious Hazard Preparedness Unit. Briand tells VOA that getting the right message out to the public is not always easy.
But I think it's a challenge of the 21st century. Because we are all beneficiaries of those extremely intense and fast communication, but also we could be the victims of it. So I think this is why it's very important to characterize the phenomenon and to develop methods to tackle it appropriately.
Briand says confronting false information head-on is not censorship. Rather, she says, it is a way of responding to people's concerns in the best way possible, given the evidence that exists at the moment. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And China says that the death toll on the mainland has reached 490. A federal judge okays a limit release of Pentagon Papers case records. AP correspondent Mike Rossi.
A federal judge has ruled the government must release some records on two grand jury investigations in Boston nearly 50 years ago into the leak of the Pentagon Papers. The ruling comes on a petition filed in 2018 by Jill Lepore, a Harvard University professor and staff writer for New Yorker. In her ruling, U.S. District Judge Allison Burroughs grants limited disclosure of grand jury materials, but not the unfettered access sought by Lepore. The Pentagon Papers, released by former government consultant Daniel Ellsberg to the New York Times, the Washington Post, and other newspapers, unmasked government deceit about the Vietnam War. I'm Mike Gracia.
More at VOAnews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, February 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. President Donald Trump has delivered his third State of the Union speech as Africa still is reacting to his latest travel ban.
With the addition of these four African countries, what we have here is really an enactment of the president's agenda, where he has stated a preference for immigrants from European countries like Norway.
Ama Hakasa is the executive director of African Communities Together. Malawi's restated Vice President Dr. Solus Chelema will address the nation today, Wednesday. Lesotho police have charged Prime Minister Thabane's wife with the murder of the Prime Minister's former wife, and military talks to end fighting in Libya are underway.
These talks in Geneva are meant to listen carefully to the position of the two sides on what are the conditions for them to accept this translation of a truce into a permanent and lasting ceasefire.
We will examine normalization of Sudanese-Israeli relations, and 47 Sierra Leone nurses and midwives return home after training in Ghana. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. U.S. President Donald Trump delivered his third State of the Union speech Wednesday, focusing mainly on the achievements of his 3 years in office.
3 years ago, we launched the Great American Comeback. Tonight, I stand before you to share the incredible results. Jobs are booming, incomes are soaring, poverty is plummeting, crime is falling, confidence is surging, and our country is thriving and highly respected again. America's enemies are on the run. America's fortunes are on the rise, and America's future is blazing bright. The years of economic decay are over. The days of our country being used, taken advantage of, and even scorned by other nations are long behind us. In just 3 short years, we have shattered the mentality of American decline. In just 3 short years, we have shattered the mentality of American decline, and we have rejected the downsizing of Americans' destiny. We have totally rejected the downsizing. I am thrilled to report to you tonight that our economy is the best it has ever been. Our military is completely rebuilt, with its power being unmatched anywhere in the world, and it's not even close. Our borders are secure. Our families are flourishing. Our values are renewed. Our pride is restored. And for all of these reasons, I say to the people of our great country and to the members of Congress, the state of our union is stronger than ever before.
President Donald Trump by delivering his third State of the Union speech Tuesday night in Washington. President Donald Trump's recent addition of four African countries, Nigeria, Eritrea, Tanzania, and Sudan, continues to be met with strong reaction. Nigeria's Foreign Minister Jeffrey Onyema, speaking in Washington on Tuesday, said his country was blindsided by the U.S. travel ban. He said Nigeria was not fully briefed on why it was being penalized with visa restrictions. Ama Hakasa is the executive director of African Communities Together.
What we've seen with this latest visa ban from the Trump administration is a broadening of the exclusion of immigrants from Africa or people from Africa from visiting or emigrating to the U.S. With the addition of these four African countries, some aspect of the ban now reaches about a quarter of the population of Africa. So what we have here is really an enactment of the president's agenda, where he has stated a preference for immigrants from European countries like Norway, has used slurs against African countries. So what we've seen is those prejudices turned into a policy of racial profiling for immigration.
Amaha, the Trump administration says that the addition of Nigeria and Tanzania, Eritrea, and Sudan, these countries, the administration put it, they are deficient at risk of becoming deficient in fulfilling their what is so-called requirements when it comes to, say, fighting terrorism. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that the story doesn't hold together. You know, if we're talking about a policy based on real risk of terrorism, it's notable that we can't point to examples of terrorism directed towards Americans from these countries, or very few examples, over decades. And if we're saying that it's deficiencies in screening or security, what they haven't pointed to ways that these countries are worse than other countries who are not being banned. And what makes it even less convincing is they are banning people from processes where they are extensively screened for terrorist ties, criminal activity. So the question for the administration is, why are the administration's screening procedures insufficient to catch those kinds of security concerns? And why would we expect any country, including African countries, to do better?
I don't know. What do you think? Some analysts have described, adding Nigeria, some people have described it as kind of a incoherence in U.S. policy. On the one hand, the U.S. wants Africa, Nigeria particularly, to help in the fight in countering Chinese or maybe Russian influence. At the same time, you're banning citizens from African countries.
Well, I would say that this administration has been consistent in very few things, but they have been consistent in their bias against from Africa and from other black and brown countries, and they've been consistent in their willingness to bend and break the law in order to achieve their policy goals. So I would say the fact that we've included the largest country on the African continent in this ban is obviously a major escalation, but I think it's more of the same rather than a pivot from their previous policy.
Amaha, thank you very much again. So nice that we can speak with you.
My pleasure, James. Thanks for having me.
Amaha Kasa is the Executive Director of African Communities Together. You're speaking with us from Washington, D.C. UN-sponsored military and security talks aimed at achieving a lasting ceasefire in Libya are underway. Negotiations are occurring as Libya's warring parties continue to violate a temporary truce agreed to in mid-January. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva, where the talks are taking place.
Five high-ranking officers appointed by the Government of National Accord in the Libyan capital, Tripoli, and five other high-ranking military officers appointed by rebel commander Khalifa Haftar are in attendance. This is the first time ever that high-ranking officers from both sides are getting together to talk peace instead of war. Hassan Salame is the special representative of the UN Secretary General and head of the UN support mission in Libya. He says both sides agree on the necessity to turn the truce into a permanent ceasefire. How they will achieve that, he says, is very much an open question.
That is why these talks in Geneva are meant to listen carefully to the position of the two sides on what are the conditions for them to accept this translation of a truce into a permanent and lasting ceasefire.
Haftar, who began a military assault on Tripoli nearly a year ago in April, expected an easy win. Instead, it has turned into a bloody stalemate, claiming more than 2,000 lives and displacing hundreds of thousands of people. Salame says an arms embargo imposed in 2011 by the Security Council has been incessantly violated since then. The ready availability of weapons, he says, is a source of great concern as it continues to fuel the war.
We have evidence of new equipments, but also new fighters, non-Libyan fighters, joining the two camps. Therefore, we believe that the arms embargo is being violated by both parties, and therefore by the countries who are violating as the source of these equipments or the source of these new fighters.
Salame says the Security Council has been asked to revitalize a sanctions committee to give more teeth to the arms embargo. He says that could give a much-needed boost to peace talks. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Today's Wednesday, February 5th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. The head of Sudan's ruling body, known as the Sovereign Council, met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Monday this week to discuss normalizing relations between the two countries. The meeting sparked criticism from religious leaders and some officials in Sudan for whom Israel remains a sensitive issue. Naba Muhyiddin reports from Khartoum on the meeting, which took place in Uganda.
Abdel Fattah al-Burhan's meeting in Entebbe with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu set off controversy back in Sudan, where public and government support for the Palestinians runs strong. Hundreds of protesters gathered in Khartoum on Tuesday, condemning the meeting and the idea of normalization of ties. Abdul Hay Youssef, an influential religious man and politician, described the meeting as a betrayal for Allah, adding that Burhan is not allowed to meet with Netanyahu without authorization from other officials. Government is Spokesman Faisal Saleh said in a statement he had no information about the meeting and that the cabinet had not discussed it. He said officials would wait for clarifications upon Burhan's return. And the former ruler Omar al-Bashir, Sudan built strong ties with Israel's enemy, Iran, leading Israel to consider Sudan a threat. The New York Times reported that Israeli airstrikes in 2009 and 2012 struck a weapons factory south of Khartoum that was said to be working for Palestinian militant group Hamas. Bashir's government blamed Israel for the airstrike and said it downed an Israeli drone in 2015. Sudanese political analyst Ahmed Abdul Ghani says Netanyahu's visit is part of a broad Israeli strategy.
Abdul
Ghani says normalizing relations between Sudan and Israel is an expansive step from Israel toward African and Muslim countries, as Sudan is considered a gate to other African countries. He also says this step is directly linked with Iran's expanded ties in Arab and African regions. He said that made Israel build relations with a number of countries, especially in the Red Sea region, to secure it. Netanyahu has talked about Israel expanding relations with the Arab and Islamic worlds. In October 2018, he went to Oman on a surprise visit and renewed ties with Chad in January 2019. Sudanese political analyst Al-Fatih Mahmoud says Netanyahu is trying to promote the recently unveiled U.S. peace plan for the Middle East, while Burhan is trying to advance his own agenda. Netanyahu is promoting the deal of the century in Africa generally and the Muslim community specifically. He's also looking for a permit to pass by Sudanese airspace and to make credits inside Israel, while Burhan is pursuing international financial support and lifting Sudan from United States state sponsors of terrorism list. Senior Palestinian official Saeb Erekat called Burhan's meeting with Netanyahu a stab in the back of Palestinian people, according to a statement published by the official WAFA news agency. Naba Muhyiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
Malawi's reinstated Vice President Dr. Solus Chilima will address the nation today, Wednesday. His speech comes after a five-judge panel of Malawi's Constitutional Court annulled last year's presidential election results and ordered a new poll in 150 days. Joseph Chidante Malunga is the spokesperson for Chilima's United Transformation Movement Party.
First, let me confirm that indeed it's true that he's going to speak to the nation, and it is only a norm that after this big event, you know, people would want to hear from him, and that's why he's going to talk to him. I don't want to preempt what he's going to say because I don't know, but obviously I believe it's a message that he's going, you know, to give to Malawians, probably a message of hope, I don't know. But yes, it's true that he's going to talk to the nation.
He has called for calm, but what should be the expectations of Malawians since the Constitutional Court ruled that he remains the vice president or be restored as the vice president till the next election in 150 days, which probably some people think is in August?
You know, before this, everyone was saying, oh, can we pray for our country for peace and things like that. And we kept saying that we went to court for justice, and if justice is served, we don't think we are going to be a violent nation. And this is exactly what has happened. Justice has been served, and you see how calm the country is. People are just celebrating the streets, no violence, no nothing. It means that indeed the court has done the will of the people.
How has been his reaction and that of the UTM following the court's ruling?
You know, he's not a person that would jump on top of a hill, would go on top of a hill and jump. But obviously happy in the sense that the journey has come to an end. We went to court to, you know, for us to go all the way to yesterday, and we did that. And it is exciting to everyone. And I think the president is in a jovial mood right now that finally we got to the end. So, like all other Malawians, everyone is just happy about it.
People have expressed concern that the opposition, including yours, would have a better chance of wresting power from the ruling DPP. Is there a consideration of a possible alliance in the run-up to the election, since some people suggest that you have the same objective, so why not team up?
Well, I think that is a question for another day. Right now, I think people are just celebrating the victory. People are happy that finally they got what they wanted. There are so many questions, you know, including the one we just asked now. There are so many questions that people are asking, and we believe time is going to come when those questions are going to be answered.
Now that your presidential candidate has been restored as the substantive or legitimately elected vice president of the Republic of Malawi, how are things going to go, and what are your expectations from now on till the elections?
Well, obviously, we adhere to the court ruling. But there are certain things that will require legal minds, and we will definitely need the guidance of the legal minds. And whatever the legal people are going to advise us, we'll go by that. But for now, all we can say is that we are going to adhere to what the court has said.
Joseph Chidante Malunga is the spokesperson for Malawi's opposition United Transformation Movement Party. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital Lilongwe. Lesotho police Tuesday charged Prime Minister Tabani's wife, Masaya Tabani, with the murder of the Prime Minister's former wife. The First Lady had been on the run for nearly a month. She is accused of killing Prime Minister Tabani's wife, Lepolele, days before the Prime Minister's second inauguration ceremony in June of 2017. Feko Moshoeshoe is chairperson of the ruling All Basotho Convention Party caucus.
Actually, as you know, the First Lady, Lema Zatalan, after she has been notified that she has to report herself in the police station, then we heard that she has disappeared. She has nowhere to be found. In fact, we heard from the police on a press conference today. They went to the stadium. When they get there, they only find out Lema Azaya is no more there. In fact, they tried to talk to her lawyer and trying to convince the lawyer so that the lawyer can talk to her so that you can come and report yourself at a police station. We have been told that really they have a strong case against her in a matter of Mary Polelo, the other wife of the Prime Minister, and the other lady who was with Mary Polelo, then meaning that there were two counts. The first count is the murder, the second count is one of that attempted murder. In fact, today we have been told by the police that, in fact, they have kept her in a police custody because immediately after she has reported herself in a police headquarters, then they notify the DPP, which means the Director of Public Prosecutor.
We are talking about the First Lady, and there was some indication that perhaps Prime Minister Tabani might have gotten also connected. How much is this affecting the politics of Lesotho?
Really, there's political instability. People are all over shouting about the situation. Even I heard them. I was listening to one of the local radios. Some were even saying that they can assist the family. They're going to contribute so that the family can get a private prosecution. So really, it has brought an instability, most especially in our party, most especially in our government. Really, things are not good. They are not in a normal situation.
The police said they have a strong case against the First Lady.
Yes. In fact, he has repeated that. He said they have a strong case against it. Meaning that he said according to the evidence that they got, really everybody understands exactly. He keep on even say, I want to repeat this again. We have a strong case in this against it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Feko Moshoeshoe is the chairperson of the ruling All Basotho Convention Party caucus. He was speaking with us from the capital, Maseru. 47 nurses and midwives returned home to Sierra Leone this month to serve in rural health facilities around the country after they completed training and education in Ghana during the past 2 years. Medecins Sans Frontières, the MSF, sponsored the healthcare workers training and will also support them as the nurses go back to serve Sierra Leone residents. MSF's Sierra Leone head office, Samuel Theodore, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the hopes for the new healthcare workers and the impact they will have.
The healthcare for human resource in Sierra Leone has always been inadequate even before Ebola. And during Ebola, one of the major sectors that got affected is the health sector, and thereby close to 7% of the human resources for health died during Ebola. So in this context, already if you see the number of human resources to be available in Sierra Leone is not at all enough according to the population size in Sierra Leone.
What are some of the main healthcare threats to the population in rural Sierra Leone? And it is known as one of the, I believe it has one of the highest maternal mortality rates in the world. Is that correct?
Yeah, Sierra Leone still is the highest maternal mortality, facing highest maternal mortality in the country among the whole world. Close to 1,360 women die every 100,000 women during the delivery time. So the main challenges for the population is access to quality healthcare services. And this is basically because at the rural sites, because 65% of the Sierra Leonean population lives in the rural areas. So access to receiving quality health care is always a challenge.
When I was in Kenema specifically and other places in rural Sierra Leone during and right after Ebola, and I spoke to nurses, one of the main concerns was not just training, but the fact that a lot of them weren't paid. A high percentage of Sierra Leonean nurses work on kind of a volunteer basis in the hopes that they will eventually get on the salary of the government payroll. So how does this address that issue? Because no matter how well trained, obviously, a workforce is, if these mostly women aren't being paid, that's another obstacle.
At MSF, what we take into account and also consideration is we do pay the bridge salary for the volunteers posted in the health facilities that is supported by MSF. MSF works in 13 district health facilities in Kenema, and for those volunteers that is posted in those facilities, MSF is providing a bridge salary. That means MSF pays the salary of Ministry of Health for those volunteers. So this is a first step. As MSF, we do strongly advocate to the government of Sierra Leone to take into consideration a minimal package during their voluntary services that they offer.
That was Samuel Theodore, head of Doctors Without Borders Sierra Leone office. He was speaking to Reiki Shryak. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. President Donald Trump's recent addition of four African countries to his travel ban, Nigeria, Eritrea, Tanzania, and Sudan, continues to be met with strong reaction. Nigeria's foreign minister, Godfrey Onyema, speaking in Washington on Tuesday, said his country was blindsided by the U.S. travel ban. He said Nigeria was not fully briefed on why it was being penalized with visa restrictions. Malawi's reinstated Vice President, Dr. Solos Chilima, will address the nation today, Wednesday. His speech comes after a five-judge panel of Malawi's Constitutional Court annulled last year's presidential election results and ordered a new poll in 150 days. And UN-sponsored military and security talks aimed at achieving lasting ceasefire in Libya are underway. That is it for this Wednesday, February 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barty in Washington.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. Heather Maxwell. I know good music, and Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.